Welcome to Season 6 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
There's three new games coming to AllPlay.com. We have the classic French Toast reimagined with new art, where one player becomes the Toastmaster, secretly choosing a word while only communicating by repeating guesses back to the group. Each guess is judged as quote-unquote closer or not based on a criteria only the Toastmaster understands. You've got 6 rounds to read their mind and land the secret word. Then we have Torchlit, a dungeon-delving trick-taking game where timing is everything. Choose when to win tricks and when to boost the value of the number of the tricks you expect to take, while knowing that points must be split if players tie. After 3 rounds, the adventurer with the most points is the winner. And then, of course, we have the newest edition of High Society. Reiner Knizia's classic bidding game returns in a lavish Roaring Twenties edition. Outbid rivals for luxury, avoid ruinous pitfalls, and spending wisely, because the player with the least money at the end is eliminated. This edition includes refreshed art and 3 all-new cards. Definitely check out all these games at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 131, Pandemic. Today we're joined by Matt Leacock, who has been a game designer full-time for 11 years and is probably most known for doing cooperative games with a side of legacy. Thank you for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm super excited. You are wrapping up the 6th season. You are my last interview. I figured save one of the biggest best for last.
Great.
Don't tell all the other people that have been on this season.
Be our secret.
Perfect. Well, I'm so excited to have you on here. We had a lot of fun when we were traveling around Europe, so got to get to know you a little bit more. So I'm excited for everybody else who doesn't know you to get to learn a little more right now. So how did you get into designing games?
Oh, I've been designing games since I was a little kid, really. So I love playing board games as a kid. And my favorite gift for my birthday would be a board game. And I could always tell it was a game because I would shake it and you'd hear that rattle and I'd get very excited.
Did you ever break it?
No. You get that kind of heft and you can kind of tell that there's some pieces in there. And a lot of the games in the 70s were just really bad. I spent a lot of time in my childhood actually trying to make games better. And it became a hobby of mine. I watched my uncle design games as well. So he kind of showed me that this is something you could do. And it was kind of a hobby and then a side gig. Side gig started to make money and it eventually turned into a career.
That's so amazing. Did your uncle get published games or was it more just a hobby as well?
No, it was totally a hobby. He was into art and painting and all sorts of things. And just kind of making in that way was natural to him. And so he kind of modeled that behavior for me.
Oh, that's so cool. We are going to focus on Pandemic because I'd say that's probably your most famous game. I mean, you do have the Forbidden series as well, but I would say, do you think it's also your most popular?
By unit sold, it's definitely the most popular one.
Perfect. I think that's a great metric. Well, then for anyone who hasn't played the game, mind explaining how to play?
Oh, sure. So Pandemic is a cooperative game. If you buy the core set, it's for 2 to 4 players. And you're basically taking on the role of scientists and medics and so on, basically trying to save the world from a global pandemic. And when I designed it, it was kind of a novel idea. You know, we hadn't had COVID yet. So basically, you're like this heroic champion running around, working with the other players, and you're doing 2 things. You're trying to keep local crises under control. You're trying to prevent outbreaks from happening in different cities. At the same time, your long-term objective is to find the cures for 4 diseases. So if you can work together and find the cures for 4 diseases before things spiral out of control, you'll win the game.
And what made you decide to do a cooperative game?
So I had played a bunch of games with family, and a lot of the times they didn't go well. They'd be too competitive, and often really competitive games in general, all sorts of like negative feelings and so on. After playing a bunch of these, I stumbled onto Reiner Knizia's Lord of the Rings, which is the first cooperative game that I played that I really enjoyed. This is back in 2000. And I thought it was just fascinating that you could like hold 4 people's attention for like 45 to 60 minutes with just cardboard and paper, right? I mean, basically, Knizia had created an opponent for people to face out of paper and card. And I thought, wow, this is fascinating. So I was really intrigued by both the format, like, hey, this is a game where we can play and regardless of whether we win or lose, we're going to feel good. And also like the systems design behind it, like how can you create an opposition for people to fight against? Just using chipboard and cards. I decided to try my hand at it, and I thought diseases would be a good place to start.
Interesting. So is that kind of the inspiration was from the mechanism of a cooperative game?
There was a lot of different things, I think. I'm not sure what was the catalyst, per se. There was a soup of things. So it was like an interest in cooperative gaming, a real strong desire to try to make a game with chain reactions. I had done a game with chain reactions in it as a kid, where you're like colliding nuclear particles together. And my thought was, wow, what would happen if you had like the nonlinear growth components and you needed more bingo chips in the game than there were particles in the universe, that sort of thing. I love the idea of like crazy growth in a game. And then SARS was hitting, and so people were very concerned about that, and disease was very much in the news. So I think I kind of combined all those things together into those initial sketches.
And what did you focus on while you were working on the mechanics for it, as far as how the disease spreads or how the different asymmetric characters work together?
Yeah, the spread of the disease was definitely something that I tackled earliest. So I just took a piece of newsprint. I had a big sketchbook and a Sharpie and some cubes, and was just playing around, just trying to figure out, like, how can I model the spread of disease just using a deck of cards? And so I used these multi-use cards. At the time, though, when I was first sketching, it was just a poker deck. And I labeled all the nodes after the poker cards. It was like a Queen of Hearts space, you know, which would be a city. It was just a stand-in for like, hey, how could I sketch something and see if I could make something work? When I was doing that, it was clear to me that if I just ran through the deck, each city in the world would get one cube, and it wouldn't be very interesting. So I had the thought of like taking the discard pile, shuffling it, and putting it on top in order to reinfect areas. And I noticed when I did that, my heart started to kind of pound. And I saw that like things could really rapidly grow. And that kind of feeling got me intensely interested. And that was the one I was kind of chasing for the rest of the design. So that was the initial hook for me and got me excited about designing it. The asymmetrical player powers was something that came much later. Initially, I thought that the players would all be collectively like running three different pawns around the board. No one even had like their own like avatar in the game, right? You're all kind of sharing a group. And I actually had actions that allow you to add pawns. It was kind of a strange initial design. It was only later when I was showing the game to some other people that were like, hey, you know, maybe you should have each player be a pawn. It seems so obvious in retrospect, but yeah, that definitely made the game better.
Yeah, because sometimes it's cool when it's a cooperative game and you have access to all the characters, but I could see how that probably was the right choice.
Yeah, it allows you to kind of identify. You're kind of embodied in the game. It brings you into it. You can kind of step into the shoes of one of those pawns.
Do you feel like there's any character that is your favorite to play or that most people gravitate towards?
I think a lot of people really like the medic in the game because it feels very powerful. So it's sort of like the big effect role. My favorite character is the dispatcher because I like all the different ways you can solve problems and interact with the different combinations and so on.
Did you get to pick which cities were put into the pandemic?
Yeah, I did. I pulled a bunch of stats off the internet of the largest cities in the world, and then that was a starting point. But I didn't want the entire game to take place in China and India. So basically, I looked for different, you know, like, what are the largest cities in, you know, North America, South America, you know, around the world. I mean, Sydney wouldn't even be on the chart, you know, if I was just going off population. So tried to get them distributed a bit. And then, yeah, we chose Essen, of course, as a nod to the gaming community. And then we had Toronto in the first edition. That was changed to Montreal when went to second edition because the publisher.
Oh, that's so funny. I always get curious when I see a place or where you have to choose locations. I assume it's always a combination of like, what are the bigger cities? But also like, how do you spread them out so they're not super clumped up? Because I know you're from California. There's a lot of big cities in California, and you don't want them on top of each other.
Right, yeah. And then we actually just spread the nodes apart from each other on the board just to make it playable. Wanted to make sure that we show little zoom lines so people knew that we knew actually where those cities were.
So I know you know that geography exists. And you know,
yeah, right. Geography exists. We actually understand that, yeah.
That's so funny. Oh my God. I'm sure you had a play tester at some point make that note. So you're like, we have to have this.
Yeah.
And then when you were trying to figure out the system for how things operated and moved in the turn order, where did you start with that?
It was sort of a back and forth. So the players would take their actions and then the game would respond. It's a pretty straightforward structure. But initially, you could spend like actions or cubes. So I had this very strange economy where you could collect cubes into a personal supply, or you could take certain actions, or you could spend cubes for actions. And it was a real mess. And it was a bit of a breakthrough. I'm like, you know, I can get rid of these cubes altogether and just give everybody four actions. Again, like, this is something we take for granted now, but at the time it was sort of new to me. That the only action economy game I had played before this was, I think, To Call, where you've got like 10 per turn and certain things cost certain numbers of actions. So I basically, in just testing and trying to simplify things, I got it down to the 4 action count.
It's harder for you because you had to like create a lot of these design bones where now people are taking from inspiration from, say, your game when trying to work this out. So I'm sure it was a lot harder back then.
I mean, it was harder in certain spots, but of course I was building up of the things like multi-use cards from Web of Power. That was a big inspiration. The variable player power is pulling from Cosmic Encounter. I'm trying to think of other things like even the usability of the cards, making them different orientations and the way they were communicating the information. I think I lifted from Transamerica. So, you know, every game builds on other games. But yeah, some of the stuff, it still surprises me. Like, wow, I had to work through that. That wasn't obvious to me at the time.
Yeah. How did you go about playtesting the game?
So I tested this for a long time. I think development went over the course of 3 different years. And I tested it first with friends and family. But I also brought it to work quite a bit. I was working at Yahoo at the time, and we'd play at the lunch hour and so on. So I got some good advice from that group. I was really interrupting people when they're playing and pointing out mistakes. And I was fortunate that I was working with some great design researchers. I was doing user experience design at the time. So I work with great researchers. And they're like, you really can't do that. So they weren't as polite as that. I remember one of my colleagues saying, you need to go sit in the corner and shut up and watch. So I did that. It was excruciating. At the time, I had a different structure for the way that the card decks worked, and players were continually discarding their cards into the wrong place on the board and messing up everything. And so I had to like face some hard truths that, you know, the game was too hard to play, and I needed to restructure some things. But I wouldn't have gotten that if I didn't get that good advice. I also brought it to the Gathering of Friends on 2 or 3 different years and got a lot of expert feedback from people who were playing it, people who had designed other games or publishers and so on, that really helped me shape it.
Do you feel like your day job at the time helped? I mean, beyond just the feedback you were getting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So working in user experience design, you learn all about iterative design process. I was doing paper prototyping back at the time for like web design, which seems totally archaic now. But it allowed you to do a really quick iteration in the lab. We were also doing a lot of field studies where we'd bring cameras. And at the time, these were big cameras, like not quite TV camera size, but really big cameras because the technology wasn't there yet, and recording people in the field. And so I thought, I can use similar techniques. I can video record people playing the games in the comfort of their own home. When I'm not in the room, it's going to get much more naturalistic behavior, and I can watch that. I didn't start doing that. I didn't do Pandemic that way, but starting with Pandemic the Cure, I definitely did a lot of remote testing, and that was really picking up skills that I learned in the field. And of course, I had a full tool set. I work in Adobe Illustrator really rapidly and that sort of thing, so that helped a lot.
You didn't just stick with the deck of playing cards that you scribbled on?
Well, that's great for the first iteration, but you quickly realize if you want to make a change, then you have to make that deck again, and being able to like change a symbol in Illustrator and have it propagate across all your cards is really quite handy.
Oh, I would agree. I'm a huge fan of the Adobe programs and Data Merge. That has saved me hours of time. And how did you end up finding a publisher for the game?
So I brought the game to, like I said before, Gathering of Friends, and there's a lot of publishers that are just playing and often looking at prototypes. And because I had honed the game over several years, the second or third time I brought it there, it was actually in really good shape, and people were very excited about it and really enjoying it. And they were bringing publishers over to me, which was really great, saying, hey, you got to check this out. And so I think I had 5 or 6 publishers interested just from that one show, and ended up sending out prototypes to them. And Dev Schlossinger from Z-Man was the first to write back and said he was interested in publishing it.
So the game came out in 2008. Was that your first published game, or did you have ones before that?
I think it's the first one that really counts. I ran 200 sets of a game called Lunatic's Loop Off on my printer, and I brought them to Essenspiel in 2000. But they were handmade and put into like Kinko's boxes, and the cards were on business card stock. It was a pretty low-rent affair. So I guess that sort of counts, but this is the first one that was published by a legit publisher and went into distribution and so on.
That's so funny. My dad is a huge fan of Kinko's, so I appreciate the nod.
Oh, yeah, I worked at Kinko's for many years.
Did you really?
Yeah, as a graphic design student, it was a great place to work.
Oh, I'm sure. I actually almost worked for them, and then I took a different job. And so what kind of development changes happened once it was signed with Z-Man?
Very little. Let's see. When we were testing it, we did realize that it was fun to see what happened when you played the game, when the role that you had depended on, say you're really into the medic, wasn't available, and you had to like play it differently. So basically just learning that, hey, it's kind of fun when you got more variety from game to game by having a bigger role mix. So he asked for one more role, and I cooked up the dispatcher then. So I think at the time I brought it from like 4 to 5 roles or 5 to 6 roles, something like that. Maybe it was, no, 6 to 7. That was it. It was basically unchanged aside from that.
And at what point did you add kind of like the event cards, and how did you figure out which ones to put into the game?
Yeah, that came as a side effect of splitting the deck. So when I first started designing it, there was a single deck of cards for the player deck and the infection deck. And so at the end of your turn, you draw 2 cards from this deck, and then you'd use the same deck to put infections out into the world. And when you got an epidemic card, you'd shuffle the discard pile and put it on top. It's a very strange way of playing the game. It worked, but the problem was that players, they had to discard the cards into the player card discard pile or the infection card discard pile. And humans just can't do that. People just fail that over and over again. So the hard truth I had to face was like I needed to introduce like 50 or 60 new cards into the game, like an entirely new deck, and I was worried about the cost of that. But I saw that once I did that, people could handle it and understand it, and it also allowed me to put cards that didn't have to function as infection cards in. And so I tried putting some events in and saw immediately that they were really useful because they allowed people, basically they helped drop downtime. So if you draw an event card and it's my turn, your brain is sort of on an idle loop. You're thinking, oh, should I play this event card now? Is this a good time to play this event card? And you're drawn in more because you can play it at any time. So yeah, I was very excited about those. And then I think the effects that I put in there were just maybe the first 5 that I came up with. They worked out. And so those are the ones that went in there. It was only after the game came out and they asked for an expansion that I really had to kind of think broadly and work with Tom Lehman on coming up with a bunch of other expansion ideas and other event card ideas.
Hey, sometimes those simple ones are the right solution in the very beginning, especially if you're trying to onboard people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What are the simplest, most powerful effects that you can, you know, crisply explain?
Mm-hmm, totally. And how did you figure out how to scale the difficulty?
I think I played it a bunch with 5 epidemics and then possibly did 4, or we did a lot at 4 and thought, oh, we'll do 5. I do know that I wasn't entirely sure if 6 would be possible to win the heroic level. I didn't test that very much. We just put that in there thinking, okay, well, that'll be really hard.
You are a straight up hero if you did it.
So we knew 4 was easier than 5, and 5 seemed like a good level just based on lots and lots of testing. I will say that the game was perceived as being extraordinarily difficult when it came out. Like, a lot of people would stay up all night playing it. They'd play it and then lose, and then, you know, we're going to keep playing this until we win. And then I hear these stories of people just playing it, like, 6, 8, 10 times in a row. I think that the hobby game community has actually gotten pretty good at cooperative games, and so now you wouldn't have the same reaction. But when it came out, it was perceived as a pretty difficult game.
That's so interesting. Do you fall into the camp that when the players lose a co-op game, you as the designer win because your AI beat them?
Oh, no, not at all. I want them to be on the edge of their seat until the end and then have a really dramatic finish, either win or lose. I don't want you going into the game knowing if you're going to win or lose, right? That if you won, it was hard fought, and if you lost, it was due to a mistake you made that you can do better next time, and why don't we play again, that kind of thing. So I have a hard time like saying, oh, well, you know, I want my players to win this percentage of the time or lose this percentage of the time. I don't think that's the right metric. I think it's more like, hey, you know, how close to victory or defeat are you? And if you win or lose, do you blame yourself or do you, you know, credit yourself or do you blame the game or credit the game? I think that's much more important.
No, I think that's a good way to look at it. And I know I've talked to you before about this, but how do you come up with the naming conventions for the different difficulty modes? I know everyone has like a different, do you start with beginner or like standard? Like what terminology did you use?
Yeah, so it actually varies across the different products that I've got, but I do sort of like standard for a quote standard difficulty so that people can benchmark their performance against other players. So like there's just a commonly agreed upon, like if we play the game and you win, you're assuming it's like quote the standard game. For a while I had novice in Forbidden Island, but I don't like that as much. I think intro is better. It's less judgy, you know, let's play the intro game. I could also see maybe in some future edition of one of the games just having like a chill mode for people who just kind of want to have a chill game. They don't really want to stress out over it, you know, something like that.
You know, I just want to be real chill in this pandemic.
Well, yeah, maybe pandemic's not the right game for that kind of level, but you could imagine some game with lower stakes having a chill mode where you're you know, you've got an opposition, but it's not too hard, and you just really enjoy the puzzle, but not at a, you know, you don't want to be stressed out for most of the game. I think heroic and legendary, that kind of terminology, probably came from playing Halo and seeing how Bungie had named some of their levels, and those worked pretty well.
Okay, because I feel like I go advanced or expert, but you know, those ones do sound more fun and like a video game.
Yeah, they had really fun descriptions as well that I never lifted, but they were like, for the easy mode, they said something like, your victory will melt like ashes in your mouth, things like that.
Oh my god, and you mentioned that they had you start working on an expansion, and at this point you have expansions, you kind of have spin-offs. Can you tell us a little bit more about those if you want to do kind of a quick synopsis of a few of your favorites or the ones that you think are notable?
Oh, wow. Yeah, there's a lot. So the first one was On the Brink. And I think this is one of the more successful expansions, really, on the Geek as voted by players. We just packaged in a lot of different ways to play the game. And I think the favorites for most of the players were things that you could just add in. You didn't have to learn any new rules. You could tack in another disease, and the rule weight was pretty low. Or, you know, even simpler, you've got new roles and new events that you can just shuffle in and just play, and you get more variability. And then we put in some bling in there. We had the petri dishes, and we did put an oppositional mode in there for people who wanted to see what that was like, where you could be one player playing against the other players. But I'm not sure how often that actually got played. We followed that up with another couple expansions that did similar things, you know, added variety or added different challenges. And then there was a push from the publisher also to investigate other ways to expand on the series. So there's a dice version.
Rapid Response?
Actually, it's called Pandemic the Cure. Rapid Response is a different one done by Kane Clanko, which is set in the world of Pandemic, but doesn't really have any Pandemic DNA.
Yeah, I kind of remember it. You're like on an airplane.
Yeah, you're doing some sort of like a rapid response unit, like responding to different emergencies around the world.
And then you have like Fall of Rome?
Fall of Rome. Yeah, so we did a series of games set in different countries because at the time they're tied into the Pandemic Survival World Championship. So it was a competitive sort of like teams of two players would compete against each other in this championship, and they're the winner of the world championship could fly anywhere on the Pandemic board. I think we did that for about 4 or 5 years. But the thing there was that the tournament was held in a different country every year, and then I designed a game that was tied into that host country. So for 3 years I did that. Yeah, we did Pandemic Iberia, set in the Iberian Peninsula for, you know, when it was held in Spain. Rising Tide, set in the Netherlands. And then we did Fall of Rome when it was set in Italy. And I just couldn't keep up that pace. So.
Yeah, that's rough. Especially because you have no idea who's going to win.
And then there's the whole Pandemic Legacy series. So three of those were very successful.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious. You went season 1, 2, and then 0? What's up with that?
Right. So Rob and I did Pandemic Legacy. And then when we were almost done with it, Sophie Gravel, who was running Z-Man at the time, said, we're going to put season 1 on the cover. All right. Because we think maybe you'll want to do more. Like, oh, okay. So then we did a season 2, and we kind of inverted a lot of the things that were happening in the game just to kind of mix it up. And then it was time to do a third one, and we thought it would be fun to do a prequel. So that's why it's season 0. That kind of explains the origin story of the game.
That's so funny. So talk to me about creating a legacy version for Pandemic.
Right. So let's see. Partnered up with Rob Davio on this, who's like the guy who invented the format. I had played Risk Legacy when it came out and thought it was pretty cool. It was a huge toy box full of different design solutions. I mean, you get to play with stickers and boxes and surprises and a story. It just seemed like a really fun place to play. I asked to get in touch with him, and I got his contact info and asked him if he wanted to work on it. And he just wrote back yes in like giant type. And we've been working together for, I think, 15, 16 years now on different games. But yeah, he's given that format a tremendous amount of thought, and he's very smart when it comes to story. And it was just a real joy to be able to kind of explore that format with him. So for people who don't know the Legacy format, I mean, it's a game that's changing every time you play it. It's evolving, and it gives you this great opportunity to tell a story. He had done Risk Legacy and Seafall. I'm not sure Seafall had come out at that time. And we dove into Pandemic Legacy. I was thinking that it would be too much work. I wouldn't be able to handle it. I was working at a startup at the time. But then I started sketching some ideas in a notebook, and I'm like, the ideas just started to get away from me. There's just so many things we could do. So I contacted him, we started working on it. And it was just so much fun watching people on video playtest this thing. The engagement was just off the charts. So I think we kind of knew we were onto something. When it came to developing it, though, we were pretty careful to not try to design the entire thing. We found that it was easier to design one game and then test it, and then, you know, figure out a couple more and then test those, and just keep going back again and again, running through with new groups. So one group would play game one and two, and then we'd develop it and modify things, and then design games one, two, three, and four maybe, and then give that to another test group and study that with a few groups and so on. Because it's pretty easy to kind of go off the rails if you make a mistake early on. It propagates through all the subsequent episodes. But it is a lot like designing many games at the same time. So it's a lot more work.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, and you need that base beginning levels to work. Otherwise, you're redoing everything, and that just sounds like a headache.
Yeah, I'm going through that right now.
I hate to hear that. Damn.
Oh, it's fine. We're working on something, and we got a little ahead of our skis, and so we're doing a little reset.
Honestly, trading card games and deck building games that expand, I look at them and go, how do you not make older versions of these not work? Like, I just feel like some things just get overpowered and you can't mix them with the old stuff.
Yeah, I can't imagine the trading card games. I think that happens, right? In many cases, you have to deprecate cards and figure out all sorts of rulings and so on.
Oh, totally. I mean, that's why people can make money playing Magic and just breaking decks as their job, pretty much.
Exactly.
That's so cool, though, with like Pandemic Legacy. I feel like just being able to work with someone who it sounds like you didn't really know, Rob, beforehand.
No, we did not know each other.
Wow, and you just like clicked.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well. I mean, we both bring different skills. We both worked on the core design together. I mean, it's very much a collaboration and all that. But yeah, he has a very strong story sense. I'm a trained graphic designer, so I could do a lot of that side. So he was kind of the lead on words, and I was sort of the lead on pictures. But that said, I think there was about a 75% overlap and everything else.
I feel like it's so fun when you can find someone who's an excellent co-designer or partner on designing, and it sounds like you definitely found like someone.
Yeah, and we continue to work together. I don't know how many games we've done together. It's been quite a few so far.
Aw, that's awesome. What did you find to be the most interesting thing you learned from working with him on the Legacy games?
I think there's a certain fearlessness to it, like just being able to experiment with something that sounds crazy, being willing to revisit something and let go of something. So I have a tendency to kind of hang on to things a little too tightly. So I can think of things where we've gone and said, this just isn't working, and we'll toss it. And like, you know, maybe it's a month of work, but you're like, well, okay, it's just not working. So it's been really great to be able to work with someone who is able to make those kinds of hard choices. But he's also just really playful, and he's got a great sense of humor. So it brings a certain lightness to things, which is really helpful. I have a tendency to kind of like, I can write precise language, but a lot of my stuff will end up sounding like a robot. I mean, for good or bad, sometimes that's good in a rule book. And then his is a little bit more humanistic. I should say a lot more humanistic. And betwixt the two of us, we can kind of find the happy middle ground.
That makes a lot of sense. Did you learn anything new about Pandemic while working on Legacy? Because I know you're kind of building from what people already know and what they love, and trying to figure out a way to extend that, I'm sure made you like do a deeper dive on what people enjoyed about the original games.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I had no idea the system, like a lot of the core elements of the game are as robust as they are. I've lost track of the number of products that are in the line. Maybe it's like 20 or 24 of them. And I, you know, when we were asked for the expansion, I'm like, I don't know. I think this is kind of fragile. I'm not sure we're going to be able to do it. And then we did On the Brink. I'm like, okay, well, yeah, that can take some changes. And then doing Pandemic Legacy, you really do get to see where you get to stretch it and see where it breaks and what you can do and experiment with. Playing around with objective systems is really helpful to kind of understand how you can create different challenges for people. And then you can push and pull on the sort of the threat engines and come up with different ways the opposition faces the players. There's a lot of different levers in the game. So doing those games is a great way to figure out where the envelope was, or at least kind of push on a little bit.
When you were working on them, were you given a price point that the games had to be as far as the materials that would be included by the publisher?
No. When we did the first one, it was very much, go make a Pandemic Legacy game. And so we did. And then they came back. We worked with them on the product design as well. Like, how is this going to fit in the boxes? And how many packages will we need? We had a very late stage change. We had specified sticker cards in the Legacy deck. So as you play the game, you go through this deck of cards that kind of tells the story. And we wanted the players to get these stickers along the way. It just turns out that collating those cards into a deck in a prescribed order was extraordinarily hard and expensive. So we needed to figure out a solution for that. And that's where the dossiers came from. It was basically a advent calendar type deal. So when you got to the place in the deck where you needed to get a sticker, you go open a door in an advent calendar. We found that it was actually even more fun than when we had planned. But none of that, all that kind of like shook out from the constraints of the design. And the publisher was like super willing to work with us on like determining what this kind of like new genre was, in a sense. And then the subsequent games, season 2 and season 0, then kind of took season 1's form factor as a given. And they were easier and harder to design. I mean, they were easier because we kind of figured out the format, but they were harder because we didn't want to repeat ourselves.
I could see that. Like, people want to expect certain parts, but they want to look for something new, because otherwise, why buy a second? Especially if it's kind of a throwaway game afterwards.
For sure, yeah. So in the second one, we wanted to kind of like invert things and, you know, basically subvert expectations. What would happen if you open up the board and you can only see like 25% of it or 20% of it, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And what was special about the Hot Zone versions of Pandemic?
So Hot Zones were basically an idea. The idea was to create a smaller, more portable, less expensive, easier way to learn Pandemic. So a lower price point. I think at the time we were thinking it'd be like even as low as like $15. We were trying to replicate what Ticket to Ride had done, honestly, with their, they've got the New York edition, San Francisco one. I think that players of the Ticket to Ride series have a stronger affinity for a city than players of Pandemic have for a continent, though, right? I think it worked okay. I just don't think the audience was really large. It was a easy, like, low price point way to introduce someone to the series, but I'm not sure a lot of people were actually looking for that.
That makes sense. It's always interesting to see what publishers try. I assumed it was their idea, not yours.
I don't know. I think it came out of a conversation when we were talking about different products we could do.
That's so cool. And so for the base original game, how long do you think it took from that initial inspiration to the game being published?
About 4 years. I started in 2004, about 3 years of development, and then I did the pitch in 2007, came out almost exactly a year later in 2008.
And how much input did you have on the final product as far as like art and graphics, especially with your background?
Yeah, I had a lot. It wasn't necessarily by choice. It was just that Z-Man was Zev, and so he farmed everything out. So he found a illustrator for the cover artwork, and then worked with graphic designer Josh Capel, did the graphic design for the 2009 edition. And so basically, whenever he got new artwork or graphic design in, he would just send it to me, and it would have like a message that said, what do you think? I had to go through and do a lot of proofing and a lot of feedback on it. Early versions of the cover needed a lot of work because he didn't have any art direction. So I won't say that I art directed it at all.
You art corrected?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, like, so one of the early sketches showed like burning bodies and mayhem and sirens and stuff. And I'm like, okay, that is not what this game's about. It's about a team coming, pulling together and being heroic, right? I wanted a heroic female scientist front and center on the cover just to show, you know, some diversity across the cast. It's a worldwide thing. We should represent the world here and like focus on like people overcoming these problems, not on the scariness of what a pandemic is like. So I think the first edition cover did that. I was very happy when we did the second edition 2013 because it's much more professional looking. They were trying to get the game into big box stores and really needed to update the cover there. But yeah, to answer your question directly, I had a lot of input on it.
And as a designer, do you prefer that?
I do. I still do. I spent, I think, about 13 hours reviewing drafts of the next Legacy game that we're working on yesterday and the day before, just going over everything, like calling out this apostrophe is not a curly apostrophe, that kind of thing, right down to the nitty-gritty, yeah. I think you build up a relationship with certain publishers. They trust you for certain things. And so I've been able to add value there. It's definitely a trade-off. I do that and I'm happy to do it for games that I think are going to have a longer print run because it's worth my time. If I'm working on some other kind of smaller project, I think I would resent it more. You know, I feel like, hey, you should be helping out here. But it's also great when you're doing it in conjunction with people who are really, really skilled at their jobs. So then you feel like you're just like, multiplying the value that they're adding. So I love working with teams that are like far better than me at things like illustration and graphic design. And then I can help add value, but I don't feel like I'm the last line of defense. That's when I really get kind of scared and annoyed.
I feel very similar. I feel like I'm too rusty to be a professional graphic designer at this point. I'm sure I could bring back the skills, but I definitely can point out what should be edited and fixed. And when someone has those skills, it just looks so much better.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I do not want to do the graphic design for the final product at all. And I want to use my stuff. I'm like, you're doing something wrong here. You need to find someone who's a lot better than me. But I can do a really solid prototype. And I can point, basically have a scaffolding that shows whoever is going to pick up the project. Oh, okay. You know, I know what this is for. I know what this does. I get what you're going for here.
And I think that's really important because, I mean, the UX and graphics, I think, is more important than any kind of illustration in a prototype. As long as the symbols make sense, you're going to be able to play the game a lot easier.
Yeah, I think of the iconography, for example, in the prototypes needs to be as good as the text. It doesn't necessarily have to be the final text, but it's got to be really good and close. And then someone else can brush it up, maybe lighten up the copy a bit, or certainly make it more technically accurate. Same thing with the icons, but they've got to read correctly when you're playtesting.
And then do you have a favorite and a least favorite experience of making the original Pandemic?
Oh, wow. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, most of my favorite experiences are watching people's reactions to it. Because, I mean, the thing is it's like a emotions generator. So it's, you cook up these little projects and you put them in a box and you hand them to someone. Sometimes it feels like you're making a bomb and like handing it to somebody. And then you get to see what kind of emotions spill out. So I think my favorite experiences are really just seeing what kind of emotions that are unpacked when people play it. Least favorite? Probably just, I'm not really sure. I guess maybe it's opening up the first box, opening it up and seeing that there were these really crazy things from the factory when we first got the first print run that smelled terrible. This is back in 2008 and production in China was not what it is today. And so like we had collated cards. You know, if you've got two Cairo cards in your Pandemic set, it's going to make Cairo really deadly. So we had things like that, and like the games were moldy in some cases and smelled bad. So that's all in the rearview mirror. That was only the first printing. Zev changed printers right after that.
That's like a good choice.
That one stands out as not a particularly good memory.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. That's wild. I can't imagine that happening now. I mean, I've had weird things that have come up, but never that. And do you have a biggest takeaway from the experience of designing Pandemic?
I think it was really useful to play test with a huge variety of people in a lot of different settings and get a really big diversity of opinions on it. Because I can point to a lot of different groups of people that I played with, and I can think of a lot of different types of insights I got. And if I only listened to one group, the game would still probably be good, but I don't think it would be as good as it ended up being. Because there's different voices involved, and I think it really helped quite a bit.
How did you find the different voices?
It wasn't anything really scientific. I was basically just trying to play it with as many people as I could. I brought it to work. I played it in convention settings. I played it with my family, like my non-gamery mom and so on. I played it with my grandmother. That's not something you can do with every game, right? I was looking for something that would have wider appeal. So that worked pretty well for this one. But I don't really have a scientific method there. It was just a matter of like trying to cast a wide net.
Do you feel like you got more from players playing, I guess the same group of players playing the game multiple times over, or from that first play experience with different players?
Probably the first experience with different players, if I had to choose one of those, because I was really focused on that first time experience, I think, more than anything. I did get some really good insights. I do recall playtesting this in my living room one time, and one of my playtesters saying, you really need to make a call on where the epidemic cards go in the player deck, because I was waffling on it, and I didn't want to bother people with the way you create that deck is kind of onerous. You have to like divide it into five piles and shuffle an epidemic in each pile and stack the deck, and it's hard to describe and it takes a long time. So I didn't want to force playtesters through that process because it's annoying. But I did find that if people didn't do that, they could have really bad games. It was just either boring or way too stressful or whatnot. It was one of the players who had played it several times. She was like, look, you've got to make a call on this, and I need you to tell me right now which way to do it. And that helped quite a bit. And I don't think I would have gotten that kind of feedback if someone hadn't played it repeatedly.
Oh, that totally makes sense. And do you have any projects that you're allowed to talk about that fans should be looking forward to?
Let's see. So still hoping that Flickering Stars will be out before too long. It's a dexterity game that I worked on with Josh Capel, who actually did the illustrations for the original Pandemic. This is a game where you're flicking spaceships across the board, completing objectives. And it's super toy-like and really fun. So hoping to get that out next year. I don't know if I can talk about anything else. Well, I can say that Animal Rescue Team just came out last week. So this is a cooperative game for 1 to 4 players where you're rescuing animals, and also has very toy-like pieces. You're loading specialists into these vehicles and rescuing animals that also you get to load up and deliver to shelters. And The Four Doors, a cooperative game for 1 to 5 players. And this is basically just a single deck of 60 cards with 5 pawns. So if you're looking for a really portable, puzzly game, a bit like Forbidden Island, really, but in a very portable sense, that came out last month.
That's awesome. So lots of cool stuff and more that you can't say.
Oh yeah, there's a lot more I can't say, but very much under development.
Noted. For my last question before we end the show, if you could have been the designer of any game that's currently published, which game do you wish it was?
Ticket to Ride, because it's basically Rummy on a map, and it's so straightforward. It looks like this design that's just sitting there and obvious.
That's a good answer. You're not the only one who's thought of that one. Well then, thank you so much for everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 131, Pandemic. The closer to the 6th season, we only have our recap left. Matt, I appreciate you coming on to the show. For anyone trying to find you online to track what games you have coming out, where can you be followed and reached?
Best bet is to go to leacock.com. I've got a Substack there you can subscribe to, and then I'm also on Blue Sky and Facebook, but you can find all that from leacock.com.
Sweet. And I've been your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find my personal social media, you can find me on Instagram and Blue Sky under the name Token Gamer, spelt with a Y. And then if you're trying to find some fun short form video tips, which Matt has been on, you can go to Game Design Unboxed on Instagram and TikTok. Thank you so much for being on the show, and hopefully everyone will subscribe and keep listening to more episodes in the next season.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out allplay at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.